It is Monday, best night of the week. How welcome everybody here. It's Monday. It's the 1st of August. We're getting out of summer, hopefully soon, because I'm dying in Florida. Anyway, how you doing, Sasha?
Doing really well, Helen. Great to be here with everyone. Welcome to all those who are piling in from the waiting room. Great to have you here. How are you doing, Helen, apart from the heat?
Overall, I'm doing pretty good.
Awesome. And we have Cara with us today too, who is both our host and our presenter. So awesome to have you all along here. Hey, Cara.
Hey, I'm wearing lots of hats tonight. I'm super glad to be here with y'all.
So let me introduce you to Cara Griffin, pronouns they, them. Cara Griffin holds an undergraduate degree in psychology, international relations, and criminal justice, a master's in dispute resolution and conflict management, and a PhD in anthropology. A former Southern Baptist evangelical megachurch member, they enjoy working with secular community services that support other people who have experienced judgment, repression, trauma, and other struggles related to involvement with religious groups. At RFR, Cara serves as the online programming director and usually hosts the weekly RFRX sessions. So I'm going to ask Cara to now take the stage and tell us, Cara, what is religion good for?
Well, there's a song that you might recall with some similar lyrics to that question. I'm just going to leave that with you as we think about the title of tonight's program. And I'll let you be the judge when we get to the end. But to start with, let me go ahead and see if I can pull up my screen here. I did make some slides for y'all, although I'm going to try not to make this a lecture that puts everyone to sleep. So please feel free to jump in with your questions and comments in the chat as we go along. And like Helen said, we'll try to get to those at the end or maybe some of them as we go along. So let me go ahead and see if I can share my screen here. Okay. Can y'all see that?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I like visuals. My ADHD brain is now happy.
Yes, I like visuals as well. So that is why we have a little bit of a slideshow here. So, but again, don't feel like you're being preached at or teached at. I want us to be able to have a conversation as we go along. But as you can see, we're going to be talking about religion and what it may or may not be good for tonight. And we're going to do that from an anthropological perspective. And just to start with, you know, a lot of times I tell people that I went to school for anthropology, and then they ask me, so you study ants or you dig up dinosaur bones? And no, I do not. clear that up first. And I actually completely understand. If you're not sure what anthropology actually is the study of, I wasn't either until grad school. I actually know several people with PhDs in anthropology who are still arguing about this to this day, what exactly it is that we do. But in a nutshell, the idea is anthropology is the study of humans and their recent ancestors through space and time, which to me sounds a lot like an episode of Doctor Who, which, you know, may have been part of the reason that I became interested in it, not gonna lie. But that is the perspective that we're coming from here. This is a social science. So we're not doing theology here tonight, we'll be doing social science. So first things first, if we're gonna talk about what religion is good for, we probably need to define our terms. And I kind of wanna poll all of y'all about this. Can you define religion and how would you define it? Helen and Sasha, if you want to jump in here too, feel free.
Very interesting question.
Yeah.
Well, how do anthropologists define religion?
I love the way you turned that around. That is exactly
how. That was impressive.
That is how I manage questions when I'm teaching in a classroom environment as well. So fortunately, we have slides for this. So. Okay. What is religion, you ask? The definition that we're going to go with tonight is belief in ritual concerned with supernatural beings, powers, or forces that people might appeal to or manipulate to their advantage in some way. And I want to point out that, you know, this definition includes supernatural beings and forces. I don't know how many of y'all have had this experience where someone says to you, oh, you don't believe in a God, or oh, you're an atheist or agnostic. Well, that's just the same. You're just being religious about your non-belief. I don't know. Have y'all ever heard someone tell you that?
I've heard that. Yes.
Yeah. So that comment does not fit with this definition of religion. Feel free to let people know that. However, I do want to put a pin in that idea, and we're going to come back to that later on in the episode. So keep that in the back of your head. But this is the definition we're working with. So usually, this is talking about belief systems that have to do with the supernatural and supernatural beliefs. But you know, when we start talking about concepts that we're going to apply around the world, when we're studying different groups of people in different places, sometimes we find that our definitions can be inadequate and they don't quite capture everybody, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, as it turns out, we're going around the world and maybe we realize that at some point in history or at some place in the world, actually, there's people that are participating in a set of beliefs or practices that maybe don't strictly deal with the supernatural, but maybe they have a conception of certain things as sacred, like certain places or plants or animals. Maybe they're not regarded as supernatural. They're actually things that exist in the natural world, but they're special in some way. They might be revered or worshipped. That can also be included in religion. And usually we see this characterized by a lot of ritual and sets of practices around it that are special to people. So we can still consider that a religion. And then another thing that tends to characterize religious practices is the sense of communitas, or a strong sense of community and solidarity. And usually we see people kind of collecting around this shared set of beliefs, oftentimes coming together to celebrate or commune with one another, and kind of have this shared experience that's often emotional or intense and kind of builds that sense of community. That is one of the defining factors as well when we're talking about religion. So that's what I mean tonight by religion. It's a broad topic. And, you know, the more we look around the world, the more we sometimes have to expand our definitions to include everyone, which can be problematic, but we'll come back to that later. But does that make sense? Do y'all agree with this definition, or have I?
Yeah, that's really, really interesting there, Kara, because that you're basically saying it really doesn't matter about whether it's a new religion or an old religion, whether it's from the earliest start of humanity, maybe a more tribal-based set of beliefs, or whether we're talking about new sort of formalized structures, that it's all covered under that same banner.
Yes, absolutely. That is what I'm saying, because, you know, if we get too narrow with our definition, at some point we might basically just be taking what we understand to be the religion we're familiar with and saying, well, this is what religion is because it's what religion is to me. And people that don't fit into this are doing something different. And maybe that wouldn't really be a fair way to describe the world. So, yeah, I'm going to take a broad brush here to paint with. I hope that if you're thinking in the back of your head about how sometimes people like to say, well, oh, religion is universal. Everyone has religion. Every society and every culture across space and time has had religion. Well, sure, but we have to get pretty broad with our definition of religion in order to actually capture everybody. So keep that in mind.
There some examples that you can talk about, different cultures or different backgrounds?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there are. I'm glad you asked. A real quick note before that, though, when we are looking at religion across, you know, different cultures and societies, it's important to note that if we're doing anthropology or sociology or really any kind of social science, we're studying religion as a social phenomenon, not going around trying to decide, you know, which one of these belief systems is the truth. That's the role of theology. That's not really serious academic study in the social sciences. Because, of course, if you start looking around the world at all of the religious practices and beliefs out there, you'll immediately notice there are multiple dynamic competing beliefs and practices that have changed and evolved over time and that are adapted to the local contexts where they're practiced. You really can't evaluate them in that way. So we're going to be descriptive, not prescriptive, in our approach to religion. And one of the defining sort of methods or approaches of anthropology is this idea of cultural relativism, which is the attempt to understand a belief or a practice or a value in its own context, the way the people who are believing and practicing it understand it, rather than evaluating it against your own understanding and deciding, oh, well, here are the six or seven things that they got wrong. That is what we would consider ethnocentrism. I want to point out, though, here, though, that cultural relativism is not the same as moral relativism. It does not mean that you necessarily have to approve of and accept all things that all people are doing throughout the world. We're trying to understand people in context. We don't necessarily have to agree with everything. So those two are not the same thing. But the idea here is this is kind of the opposite of an ethnocentric approach, which would be to say, here's what I believe about religion. So let me go out into the world and tell you what's wrong, which is kind of what we think of as, you know, missionary work, which is not the same as anthropology. Although I cannot tell you how many religious people have said to me something like, oh, you're an anthropologist. I was always interested in the mission field myself. So you get to go out and share your testimony with everyone, right? No, no, that's not it.
So like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds more like anthropology would be how does the religion affect the culture and their moral systems and how they relate to one and each other and the not only within their own society, but how that also reflects on the rest of the world, which their idea of how things are based on their religious upbringing beliefs.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. You know, how does this religious set of religious beliefs or practices fit into this culture? How does it affect it? And how is it affected by it? How does it change and morph over time, especially when we start seeing people overlay their religious belief onto other people's? Like, for example, in the case of missionary work, you know, a lot of the spread of some of the major monotheistic religions that are popular today, Christianity, Islam, et cetera, were spread in some cases forcefully throughout the world during, you know, periods of imperialism and colonization. And that had some pretty negative consequences when people's indigenous beliefs were run over or suppressed or erased. And those beliefs may have fit better in the cultural context that those people lived in. And I'll give you just one example of that here. If you think about a current issue that is kind of a hot button political issue in the United States and some of Western Europe right now, is this idea of gender diversity and that there may be people who are not identifying with a male-female binary in terms of gender. There is a strong push in some of the monotheistic religions that are popular today to reject that concept entirely and say, you know, God created male and female. It's in Genesis. This is how the world works. Well, in fact, much of the world does not work that way. gender diverse cultures and gender expansive individuals have existed throughout the world, throughout space and time for quite some time. And that is one of the practices that got really stamped out as some of the monotheistic religions were spread around the world. In fact, many indigenous cultures in the United States, Native American cultures, Hawaii, Australia, Africa, India, Asia, actually not just had a rich diversity of gender identities, but also many of those were associated with important ceremonial practices or spiritual or religious beliefs and were celebrated. So the repression of that or the kind of overlaying of a different worldview on top of those beliefs was in some cases catastrophic, clearly for gender diverse individuals, but also reorganized the way that people related to one another in those societies with detrimental effect. So that's just one example of, you know, why we don't go out into the world and say, here's how you got that wrong. Let me give you my idea of what is the one true way instead. That is often very harmful. Okay, so let's actually go on. Oh, and I put a link down there on this the slide here as well. If you are interested in that topic, PBS has a great interactive map that you can go to and click on to learn about all of the sort of different gender diverse traditions in different cultures across the world. And that's not all of them, but they've got a good number of them there. Okay. So Sasha, back to your question. Let's actually talk about some different ways that people practice religion around the world. And if y'all were like me, you may have gone to school, and when you were in high school or maybe college, you might have had a class on world religions or comparative religion, where you probably did a brief survey overview of the major world religions. You probably learned about Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, maybe dabbled in, you know, Taoism or a few other smaller ones. But it was probably those major ones. Or I don't know about y'all, but when I was in basically all the way through high school, I went to a religious school for much of that time, and we didn't even teach about world religions. All we learned about was our own religion and sometimes what was wrong with all of the others, just enough to straw man it and say, this is why they're terrible.
I have to relate to you on that, Cara. Yes, the same thing. The religion that I came from had the hide to publish a book about all the major world religions and to explain, of course, why they were wrong and we were right, but under the guise of it being a reference book or reference material. So I can see just how problematic that is, because there's a skewed perspective, whereas I guess what you're presenting to us is free of any bias or free of any interpretation. This is just the facts about these religions.
I mean, that's always the goal. I mean, am I ever going to be completely free of bias? No, I am not. Am I going to make factual errors? Yes, 100%. But yeah, the goal is to be as objective as one can, at least try to get there. Yeah, exactly. And that's often not what we learn in school. And so I know a lot of people, you know, come out of these comparative religion classes sometimes and thinking things like, well, you know, religion is just, everyone's just kind of seeking the same God, but maybe they call God a different name, but, you know, they're just worshiping him in slightly different ways and things like that, right? I would argue that that is a tremendous oversimplification and kind of an example of that ethnocentrism that I talked about earlier, thinking, well, the way I understand things is probably roughly the way everyone else does too. I would say there's a lot more local variation than that we tend to ignore. Yeah, let's take a look at a couple of contemporary religious practices and beliefs that you can find people practicing in the world right now. And as we're doing that, think about what it is that religion might be, quote unquote, good for, because we're going to go on to that next. But I'll just share a couple of examples. There are tons and tons of these, and I can't claim to be an expert on all of the religious practices in all of the world, but I'll share a few with you that I'm familiar with or have studied. And as some of you may know, I spent some time living in Japan when I was doing my research, and Japan is a fascinating place to live from a cultural perspective, including in terms of religion and how people practice it, because it is very different from what I grew up being used to. Have you guys ever heard the phrase that in Japan, you're born Shinto, marry Christian, and die Buddhist?
Wow. That's a huge statement.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. A lot of people in Japan will say this. It's kind of a one of those sort of shorthands that people use to explain how differently people think about religion in Japan compared to how, you know, you or I might have grown up thinking about it. And what that phrase means is actually that a lot of people in Japan will practice bits and pieces of several different religions, those three in particular, as well as others, throughout their lifespan and even in their daily life, because of the different benefits that those different beliefs or practices offer, but they may not consider themselves a member of any one of those religions. And, you know, to people like me that grew up in a, you know, evangelical fundamentalist, you know, Protestant upbringing, you know, you have to pick one. You know, God doesn't like lukewarm, you know, either get on his side or get out, was kind of the thing we grew up learning. But in fact, in Japan, it's very common for people to, you know, for example, observe some of the Shinto beliefs and practices, which actually comes from a very early indigenous kind of animistic practice that thinks about, it really centers nature and an appreciation of the natural world and kind of imbues natural objects and beings and animals with this idea of a spirit. That you can connect with and interact with. And so that's something that people might celebrate a lot when they're thinking about life and their connection to the natural world, which is why you might say you're born Shinto, and there are a lot of practices around birth and things like that would celebrate, you know, nature and the natural world. But then they say, you marry Christian. And it is the case that a lot of people in Japan will have like Christian wedding ceremonies that would look very similar to what you or I might participate in, with the big white wedding dress and all of that. There are other traditional marriage practices, of course, but many people choose a Christian wedding ceremony. And this is kind of an example of how different belief systems can sort of flow around the world from one context to another and get integrated into a local situation. And people may pick and choose pieces of that belief system and say, well, we like this one, we're going to take this, we're going to use this marriage ceremony. It's also an example of how values can become commercialized as well, because people spend a lot of money on these weddings to project a particular image, right?
So it's almost as if humanity shapes its religion by virtue of what's popular, as opposed to religion shaping humanity?
Yes, absolutely. I would say both are probably true, but yeah, we make religion and we fit it to our lives in the way that suits us best. That's just what we do. And the more you look around, you know, over time, you see these changes and how it evolves, and certain pieces get left behind, other pieces get picked up. And Japan is a great example of people doing that. Precisely. Yeah. And then go ahead.
When you were in Japan, did you go across as a Christian? Was that part of your Christian chapter of life, or how did that affect your perspective when you rolled up there?
Yeah, it did not. Fortunately, I had left all that behind by the time I lived in Japan, although I had some family members who were making some of those comments I mentioned earlier about, oh, this is your chance to go be a missionary and share your testimony with the Japanese people. And I'm like, you know, people have the internet. They can read about that if they want to.
They have Christianity in Japan.
Right. They've heard of this. Don't know if you're aware.
Jesus is.
Yes. We don't need to spread the good news. It's done been spread. Thank you. Yeah. So I did not bring that with me, although I did encounter, I would take like language classes to try and improve my skills. I tell you what, y'all, for an anthropologist, I'm embarrassingly bad at languages. There, I said it. I'm sorry. But I had to take a lot of language classes to try and be able to communicate with people better. And often I would run into people who were, you know, similarly taking language classes, and they were from the US usually, and they were missionaries. And they were there to proselytize and coming to learn the language so they could, you know, share the good word. And it's already there. They got it. They have the internet. They can read it about that if they want to. but you know, people do pick and choose from it. And also, like I said, you know, the idea of, you know, you die Buddhist, they also pull. Many people practice and believe elements of Buddhism, which, you know, suits itself to, you know, death rites and rituals and, you know, thinking about the interconnectedness of all things. And, you know, people will practice many of them. And when people come and try and proselytize and say, oh, here we have the good news, this is the one true word, some people might say, oh, that's interesting, I'll take that piece. But they're not going to give up all the rest of their beliefs, which can be surprising sometimes, I think.
What do we call it? A buffet of belief, or an a la carte belief system?
Yeah. Yeah. This is perfectly possible to do, despite some things that we might have learned when we were younger. And also, I want to call your attention to the photo in the top right, because I think that as an RFR representative, I am contractually obligated to have a penis picture in any PowerPoint that I put out. That is a giant festival float of a giant penis that I saw at the annual penis festival in Kawasaki, Japan, which is a Shinto practice that is intended to commemorate and celebrate life and matrimonial bliss and childbearing and also protection from STIs. They have this big gathering every year. It was great fun. This is a picture I took there of one of the many giant penis floats going by in the celebration. It's also carried by, I don't know if you can tell in the picture, gender diverse individuals who also show up for this and are supported. And there's all sorts of fun. They sell, you know, penis shaped lollipops that people are walking around licking. And I mean, it's wild. It's a good time. I recommend it if you're visiting Japan.
I would go to that party.
Yeah, it's a good
time.
Sounds great. I want to go to the penis party.
Yes. It's the shrine associated with it. There's a line that, like,
I will
goes
bow to that penis.
To
okay.
In.
Like, even as an atheist, I'll be like, yes, worship the penis. I think that's a good message.
Right. You know, who says religious festivals can't be fun?
Exactly.
We've heard of people bowing down before a penis, so they're all good.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be done. So, you know, there's your obligatory penis picture. But okay, let's leave Japan for a little bit and let's talk about some other ways that people practice religion. And I don't want to harp on this too long, so stop me if I go on for too long, but let's look at the picture in the bottom left with the jaguar there. So a religious practice that this is more of an ontology. This is one of the practices that I think gets into the broad uses of the term religion. But in the South American rainforest in Ecuador, there are a lot of indigenous folks that live in small villages and towns in the rainforest who have a completely different way of seeing the world and their place in it than what a lot of us would be familiar with. And a lot of their practices and rituals will revolve around things that we might consider shamanism or magic, the use of hallucinogenic drugs to enter altered states in which people are believed to literally transform into jaguars, which is an animal that lives in that area of the rainforest. And the idea behind this is that their view of the world and people's place in it is that it is very much, we are interconnected with nature and with the other animals that live in the world. And there's a sense of kinship and ancestry with the jaguars and the other animals, who are treated with a sense of respect. And this informs the practices of people in their day-to-day. When they're going out into the rainforest or going out on a hunt, there's a relationship between people and animals that treats them as persons. I don't mean humans, but, you know, as if they have some level of personhood that's connected with these rituals and practices and beliefs that really constitutes, some people have argued, not just a different worldview, but literally a different world that people are living in, if you think about it in that sort of ontological way. So this is, you know, probably not remotely similar to any of the religions that we grew up with or learned about in the survey of world religions, but it is one that is practiced today by many people that, you know, seems to work well in the hostile environment, you know, that they live in. If you had to live in a rainforest and survive, you know, you might change some of the way you you think about and interact with with nature, I imagine. So there may be something to learn there.
Yeah, that's when I was pagan, that was one of the things we were taught about, like, having kinship with nature, and that they have their own spiritual life and you're connected to that spirit and all that type of stuff. I mean, like, it was not the same as I'm sure these tribes are taught living in a rainforest with jaguars. It was, I had a very ethno white idea of paganism because it's from the 1940s in England, and you know, because I did that talk, but yeah. But I see hints of that when you were talking about that.
Yeah, 100%. I was thinking about your talk too when I was writing this, and that's again another example of, you know, how practices and beliefs can change over time. We take them and we adapt them to work in our own context. It's not like we went out into the world and found the one true way and followed it exactly. It adapts to us. It's not just sitting there whole and fully formed and, oh, there's the truth of religion. I found it. No, it's something we use for a lot of different things that we're about to get to. And I'll just real briefly mention one of the probably less adaptive ways that religious belief can be used. You know, right now we've got the situation with the war going on in Ukraine with Russia, and religious belief has played a role in promoting or not promoting that warfare and political upheaval. When I don't know if y'all remember in the news a while back, the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church was coming on, you know, declaring godliness as a Russian national ideal and maintaining that Ukraine was an integral part of the Russian world. And, you know, Putin was coming on basically asserting, you know, his connection to the Orthodox faith to identify, you know, Russians and Ukrainians as part of the same, you know, national polity and all of that. And so in this case, you see religious belief, you know, mobilizing people in, you know, political ways, perhaps, you know, contributing to or promoting, you know, violence and warfare and getting people who don't know each other and have never met one another and probably will never meet one another to think of themselves as a collective group that must act in some kind of unified way towards some larger goal. And this is one of the major things that religion can do in societies that can be helpful, but can also be extremely destructive. So
Cara, you're saying that religion can often lead to conflicts and wars?
Shocking. I know. This is like brand new news to y'all, right?
You don't say. Yeah, I'm shocked.
I do. Yeah. Not shocked at all. Yeah, no. So let's talk about that. What do we learn from some of these very few examples that I've just given? What does religion do? What is it, quote unquote, good for? So there's been a lot of discussion over the years among social scientists as far as, you know, why do we have this religion? Why is it so common? What does it do as a social institution? And there's been a lot of hypotheses put forward. I've put most of the major ones or some of the major ones here on the slide. But some of these are going to sound familiar, right? So people use religion a lot to explain unexplained phenomena, right? Like, well, why is the weather doing the thing that it is? Why did this thing happen? Oh, okay, well, you know, it was a supernatural explanation. Let me craft a story around, you know, the origin of the earth and where lightning comes from, right? We're all familiar with this. Now, some people would argue that we have less and less need for that lately. We're going to come back to that. I would agree with them. But another thing is giving people a sense of power or efficacy over events that would otherwise be outside of their control, right? So like if I am worried about something and I can't control it, but I can pray to the deity and ask them to intercede on my behalf, or I can do a spell, or I can go visit the shaman, or you know, whatever the case may be, then I can have an impact on my life that I wouldn't otherwise be able to have, or at least I might feel like I'm having that influence, right?
So it's a sense of empowerment over an otherwise hopeless situation. It makes the person feel like they're actually doing something, or?
Yes. Yeah. Like, you know, for example, we're going to go visit, you know, the Penis Festival next April, and we're going to, you know, petition for, you know, protection from STIs, or, you know, maybe we're gonna pray for our loved one that God will heal them of a terminal illness. You know, these kinds of things, some things we have more control over than others, but the idea is that a lot of people will practice religion because it allows them to feel that they're having an impact on things that they otherwise wouldn't be able to. And that is very attractive for people. and gives that emotional support and psychological security that a lot of people, you know, don't always have. The other thing that we already alluded to is this building of community and solidarity, this sense of belonging. This is the thing that people often cite when they're talking about what they miss if they don't have a religion that they belong to. And this is also the kind of dangerous one too, because we just talked about the example of how, you know, building this sense of community can also be used for political ends and violent ends. And this is where we kind of fall down a hole, in my opinion, with religious practice, that we are relying on it in a lot of cases to maintain social order through internalizing these sets of moral beliefs and imagined or real rewards and punishments and mobilizing people towards collective action. Well, who says that collective action has to be positive? Well, it obviously doesn't. If you're here at Recovering from Religion, I probably don't have to tell you that there can be some downsides to participating in religious beliefs and practices. That's not to say that you don't get any of the benefits on the previous slide, but it comes at a cost. I think we're probably all, if we watch the news in any way, shape, or form, acutely aware of, you know, the rise of extremism and fundamentalism and hate groups that we've seen worldwide. Violence and warfare, which we already mentioned, that can be either generated by or at the very least propagated through religious beliefs or religious figures who may be, you know, you can make the argument that, you know, well, people are misrepresenting our religion. It's not one of warfare. Well, that may be, but nevertheless, religious fervor is often used to encourage people to violence. Or, you know, you think of terrorism, becoming a martyr for your beliefs. This is something that religion is very good at convincing people to do. Not a lot of other things are good at convincing people to sacrifice their own life for a collective goal or a political goal. This is something that is really only made possible in most cases if you have a belief system that says that your life actually is less meaningful than what's going to happen in an imagined afterlife. If you have the belief that, well, this life that I'm currently living is just a blip in time, the real reward is going to be in the afterlife, well, then you could be convinced to throw away your life for very little. This is not something that's very easy to convince people to do without religious belief. So this is one of the serious downsides. And of course, we've seen all sorts of negative social outcomes, homophobia, sexism, racism, ableism being, you know, promoted by various religious organizations just in the world right now today. And this has certainly been a historical trend too. And finally, on the individual level, I don't know about y'all, but shame and guilt and fear are often things that are experienced by people who get indoctrinated into religious beliefs that teach them things like you're going to hell, or, you know, some other equivalent of that. If you don't believe, you are born broken, you know, God is angry with you. These sorts of things can be very, very psychologically and emotionally devastating, as I'm sure you're all aware.
Yeah, that's a very powerful slide that you've got on there. And that teamed up with the previous slide, you've really summed that up very well. And one of the things we find through Recovering from Religion, and so many people that join our support groups or contact us through the helpline, is that constant balance of they feel like they've lost their community when they leave religion, but they recognize that their reason for leaving was because of many of these downsides that you have explained there, and that potentially there's a void when they leave religion and they no longer have that group, groupthink, that support structure that they were so used to. And yet then they balance it and say, but also in order to have that supportive structure, I had to abide by these sorts of abhorrent aspects that religion often promotes or at least allows to grow. So excellent slides. Thank you for those.
Well, thank you for summing that up actually really well. I think that is a place that a lot of times, you know, we kind of get stuck saying, well, religion has been providing these really good things that, you know, maybe religion is the only place we can get those things. I'm going to disagree with that. But, you know, we have all these downsides, you know, coming with it. So what do I do? It's kind of back to that first slide. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't, kind of thing. So where does that leave us? You know, are the downsides inevitable? Let's talk about that. you know, a lot of people, you know, will make the claim that, oh, okay, well, religious belief is universal. If you're not religious, you know, you're somehow an outlier. You have missed the boat. This is what humans have been doing since forever. There's really no way around it. That's just the way it is. That's it. And that's all. Well, I would like to go back to what we talked about at the beginning when, yeah, that statement may be true if you're using a definition of religion that's so broad that it encompasses, you know, a whole lot of things that wouldn't be recognizable as religious belief to the people who are saying that sentence to you, right? Like, okay, so what are you saying? I need to go out and go to the penis festival now, or go out and believe in Thor? I mean,
I could think of worse things to do, really. Thor's really cool.
a lot of people too will take that argument to say, oh, well, you know, because religion is so common and prevalent and universal, well, that must mean that it's true, right? If it wasn't true, it wouldn't have existed in all places and all times throughout society. Can anyone name that logical fallacy, by the way?
Appeal to authority? No.
Well, there is an appeal to authority involved in that. If, you know, I believe it because, you know, so and so told me to. It must be real because the book says so. I was thinking of the appeal to popularity, actually. Oh. That, you know,
ad populum, right? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, chat.
Yes. Well done. I knew somebody would get it.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Well, so many people believe it. It must be right. Well. I don't know about you, but I can think of a lot of things that people used to think that turned out not to be right. So maybe we don't want to rely on that. And also recall that we just described a lot of very different religious beliefs and practices, many of which don't purport to have the absolute truth and to be, you know, literally correct in a description of history and things like that. Again, that's kind of the way sometimes people in the proselytizing religions will frame things. That's not even necessarily a part of all of the religious beliefs that exist in the world. But just because religions exist in most, if not all, societies, that doesn't necessarily mean that all people in those societies are religious. So we had a question in the initial poll that asked what percentage of the world's population you thought might be religiously unaffiliated.
Do you want me to pull up the poll results?
Yes, I want to see what people said.
Okay.
And I don't know if I am going to be able to see it on here, so feel free to read it out for people that can't see it.
So okay. What percentage of the world's population is religiously unaffiliated? Ooh, poll results are interesting. Helen, sorry, have you got the results there?
Yeah, I do. So what percent of the world's population is religiously unaffiliated? The most common answer was more than 15%. And then way at the other end was less than 5% and less than 10%. But mostly everybody answered up to more than 15%.
Well, y'all are correct. As of results from a Pew Research poll in 2012, which is, I understand, a little bit old, the number was 16.3%, which is over a billion people in the world are religiously unaffiliated as of 2012. There's probably new numbers now. I apologize for not having newer ones, but, you know, studies of that magnitude take a while to do. but if anybody has more recent numbers, please feel free to throw them in there. But that's a lot of people. You know, you can say religion is universal, but there's a billion people that are not on that bandwagon. So yeah, you can exist without it. I was just gonna say, as a caveat real quick, that some people who are religiously unaffiliated may still have some spiritual or supernatural beliefs, but they're not adherence to a particular religion. Yeah, go ahead, Sasha.
Interesting. So the Christian religious background I came from would make use of a section from the Bible saying that happy are those conscious of their spiritual need, and they would infer that people who are not religious are therefore unhappy and unfulfilled in life. So are we saying that billion odd people who are non-religious are actually unhappy and unfulfilled in life? Does the data marry up to that?
I would say that it does not. And we're going to have a slide on that in just a second. I did want to actually comment on something that you mentioned earlier, Sasha. I don't know if you want to tell us about the latest census results in Australia and how many religiously unaffiliated people live there.
Yeah, thanks, Kara. So looking at this graph you've got on the screen about the world's least religious countries, I look at Australia, obviously being based here. Very interesting when we look at that percentage. We just had a census last year or this year. Very, very interesting data. It was one of the first times there was a question saying, what's your religious background? And there was actually a box to tick saying no religion. And that, I think the statistics were up in the high 40%. According to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. So Australia is certainly becoming a country where religion does not play as big a role as perhaps it used to in generations past. And that, of course, is affecting public office, it's affecting legislation, it's affecting the way the country is progressing in many positive ways.
That is fantastic news.
So jealous.
Yeah. I may be biased, but I like the sound of that, given the way things have been going around here lately.
Come on down under. We've got plenty of room for everyone.
Yes, I am buying my plane tickets now.
Yeah.
Me and Kara are going to get a tent.
Yes, I am ready. And if you consult the map on the right side of the screen, you can see there are, in addition to Australia, several other locations in the world you can go where, in fact, people appear to be doing just fine with very little religious belief going on in their life or in their society. I don't know about you guys, but I often get told by religious people who want to say that it's impossible to live without religion that, well, you know, you can't have a functional society without religion. Just look at the ones that tried it. You've got the USSR and North Korea and China, and look how bad those are. Well, what about most of Europe? Currently. <Yes.
laughs> Scandinavian countries, anyone? Yes.
Right. I think upwards of 70 or 80% of people in some of the Scandinavian countries identify as not religiously affiliated. Somebody check my numbers on that. But those are also, to my knowledge, some of the happiest places in the world.
Right. There's a direct correlation between the advancement of a society and the lack of religious influence upon them and how that affects people's happiness. Is that correct?
I would say there is certainly a correlation there. Can I say for sure that it's a one-to-one because no religion people are happier? You know, it's hard to make that argument, but it appears that people can be happy and be non-religious. I would say that is.
I thought I was just fooling myself.
Yeah, right. You didn't know how much you needed Jesus.
I know. I didn't know. I mean, I did know him, and then I said bye bye. But apparently, I need to let him back into my life to be the same, maybe a little bit more miserable. I don't know.
Yeah,
almost as if once the fear and the obligation and the guilt, that fog of religion, is lifted, people have the ability to rise and become free. Interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
You get to be your authentic self.
Right. I would much rather be myself than someone else or, you know, what someone told me I'm supposed to be. So, you know, I have that argument all the time with family members. And tell you what, I didn't care for their version. So here we all are.
Yeah.
But, you know, with that in mind, you know, that kind of brings us to the question, why do some people reject religion, even though they may have grown up in a religious household or a religious society? You know, how is it that there are some people going along, you know, being religiously observant, never questioning, you know, or seemingly never questioning, and other people are not? They say, no, this isn't for me. If religion is doing all these great things for us, why do people leave? So there are actually a lot of reasons for that. And I think we've kind of covered that a lot of people lately in many parts of the world have been leaving their religious faith. That's not to say that people in other parts of the world are not religious. I'm you know, when we're talking here now with some of the charts and graphs that I have, I'm talking about the United States. We're talking about Australia. We've been talking about Western Europe. So I want to make clear that I can't paint with a broad brush and say, you know, that everyone in the world is, you know, becoming less religious. We already talked about how it varies by social context, right? But I've got a graph here from, you know, Pew Research again, showing in the United States over time from 1972 until 2010. Again, this is a little bit of an older chart. We see a noticeable decline in religiosity, especially among, you know, the Protestant faiths, at the same time as a dramatic, almost threefold increase in the number of people saying that they do not identify with any religious belief at all or affiliation. And that is a huge increase over just a handful of decades. So then what's driving that? So we kind of talked about it earlier, Sasha, you pretty much summed it up. When we looked at those slides earlier, as far as, you know, what does religion provide and what are the downsides? Well, I think a lot of people have determined that the downsides outweigh the benefits, right? When we think about, well, you know, religion gives us explanations for phenomena that we can't explain. Well, you know, a lot of things that religion used to explain, we have microscopes now and telescopes and vaccines. And we do have other alternatives. And, you know, when it comes down to, you know, providing comfort in times of crisis and grief, well, maybe, but how much extra crisis and grief might it be producing? I don't need that in my life. And then
thoughts and prayers don't actually solve problems, and yet religion
yeah, continues to offer thoughts and prayers while it continues to burn down. Maybe people have noticed that that's not doing anything. I don't know.
Whereas the non-religion offer policies and change and action, and we actually do something for our society as a whole. So, yeah.
Yes. Stop making sense.
No,
using logic and good ideas. God.
Oh, I know.
Your former JWs would be so upset with you right now.
Get you on here, earning yourself a place in hell.
I know.
Come on in, the water's warm.
We're all going to get a condo next to the Lake of Fire, hanging out with Bowie and Sagan. That's the goal.
Yes. Was it like heaven for the climate, hell for the company?
Right.
I'll go for the company, I think.
Right.
Yeah. And then finally, I was just going to mention too, you know, we talked earlier about one of the things that religion tends to do is to build up sort of a common sense of morality and ethics that people, you know, will adapt to their local conditions. And I don't know about you guys, but I've started to notice lately where I live that some of the loudest voices in the religious communities that are getting the most involved in politics, and I'm talking about the evangelicals and things like that, are espousing values that don't match the ones that probably a lot of people I know hold, like, you know, democracy, equality, you know, pro-LGBT. Yes, bodily autonomy. They've
basic
found
human rights.
Yeah. Yeah. And we see people leaving the faith in droves who are particularly affected by those issues, like the LGBT plus community. Not supported? Well, religion may not be providing them these things that we normally expect to get from religious beliefs. So are we really surprised that people are leaving? It's what I'm surprised by is that, you know, some of the religious communities are not, you know, paying a little more attention to that, but maybe that's not the goal.
So where do people get their morality and ethics from then, if it's not from religion?
That's a great question.
Mr. Rogers.
Well, I mean, you know, if we accept the proposition that religions, you know, change and evolve over time and are adapted as they are useful and, you know, some could say beneficial to the context that they're applied to, then, you know, I think we all, you know, have thought in our heads before, huh, it seems like the really fundamentalist believers in this or that religion are kind of cherry picking. Even if we look at their own book, they're not really getting their morals and values from what that book tells them. They're taking the parts of that text that match their morals and values and fixating on those. We're not really getting our morals and ethics, you know, from these religious texts in a lot of important ways, in my opinion. I don't know about you guys, but I have a lot of people in my family who say that they believe the Bible is literally true and everything that God says in the Bible, you are commanded to do. But, you know, all of those people eat shrimp and wear blended fabrics. And
do they talk to women when they're on their period?
Yeah. Weird how, you know, we're not following the things that, you know, don't match the way we want to be walking around in the world. So to me, it's when people say, you know, how can you be moral without religion? It's a moot point. That's not where most people are getting their morals. That may be what people are using, the language people use to teach morals and values, but that's not really where they're coming from. Those are socially constructed, and they're, you know, going back to cultural relativism, they're going to be culturally contextualized. So yeah, I would say I would just completely sidestep that question because I don't think it's relevant, but I don't know about you guys. We can have differing opinions on that, which we can come back to later. But kind of a similar question that you brought up earlier, Sasha, is, okay, well, what if we leave religion now? Is life meaningless? Are all of the atheists and agnostics in the world walking around, you know, hopeless and unhappy and depressed and just with nothing to live for? Well, Pew Research Center asked that question. And it was a really interesting question, I thought, and I put the results here on this chart. And this is, again, in the United States, so answers may vary. Your mileage may vary if you live someplace else or if you live here, obviously. But something that they were interested in finding out, given the rise in the numbers of people in the U.S. who do not affiliate with a religion, they asked U.S. adults, what provides them with a sense of meaning. And you can see the results here sort of divided up by how people answered based on whether they were Christian, atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. And as you can see, a lot of people said that family provides them with a sense of meaning. And there's, you know, kind of going back to that sense of community again, a lot of people get that, you know, to some degree from family. And guess what? You can still have a family even if you're not religious. But we see that for Christians, that number was a little bit higher compared to for atheists and agnostics. Some people are finding meaning in life through money. And I don't know about y'all, but they say, you know, money can't buy happiness, but you know, there is a minimum threshold actually. And I've seen studies, you know, indicating that yes, after a certain amount of comfort, you're not going to get happier with more money, but below a certain level, you're going to be very unhappy if you don't have enough money to survive on, or have your basic needs met. So yes, money is important to people. But I was really interested in the third column, hobbies. A lot of atheists and agnostics and nuns find a lot of meaning in their life through their hobbies. And I'm going to assume that probably includes other kinds of extracurricular activities, possibly even volunteering for places like RFR.
And that's an interesting point too, Cara, that those figures bring out, that many who have a very deeply held belief structure might not pursue hobbies and interests in this life because this life is the temporary life. This is the life that we're enduring before we get our final religious reward in whatever the afterlife is of that particular religious flavor. So they wouldn't invest the time and the effort in making life enjoyable, pursuing hobbies, pursuing interests, because this is just the training ground that they have to get through before they get to the real eternal life.
Yes, 100%. That was my takeaway here too. It's not, you know, what are you missing out on by leaving religion? It's what are you missing out on by focusing on religious beliefs that stop you from enjoying the rest of your life? And you noticed you've got this less participation in or less sense of meaning found in hobbies and travel, especially among the people who identified as Christian here. They are not getting out much.
Which kind of makes sense, you know, because I would imagine that, you know, they're used to their bubbles and the people that think mm-hmm. like them, you know, we're, you know, those of us who want to know that this is the only life we're getting, want to experience it as much as possible and see as much of the world as we can. And the great way to do that is through travel. You know, mm-hmm. I want to travel. I want to see different, I love traveling, you know, I love seeing places that is different than living in the United States, or just see other parts of the United States and just be around people that aren't from my area. I think it's a great way to learn, expand, and become more open-minded. And if you're worried that, you know, if you travel, you're going to miss church on Sunday, you probably not get, and you're going to get in trouble for it, you might not be taking that trip to Ireland.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah. If you go out and get exposed to other ideas, you know, that's how Satan gets you.
That's right.
Yeah. You might see a penis. You might, you know, encounter you a new idea. I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen?
You're going to go to this penis festival and
yeah, all
chaos
over.
Will ensue. It's only you see the penis. It's a quick jump over into atheism and murder. That's the line.
All downhill from there. That's right. Here we are.
There's an excellent comment in the chat. Somebody's put, travel is the antidote to ignorance. That's a lovely quote. Fantastic. Yep.
100% yes.
I think Mark Twain said that, or ooh. Something similar.
Ooh, I like that.
He says something similar to that. Yeah.
Yeah. That would not surprise me at all. I completely agree. And yeah, I think that kind of sums it up here. If you look at these numbers, it kind of suggests that, yeah, people who are not religious are finding meaning in other meaningful things. And they're finding community in things that are not the religious community. Just because religious communities can provide that sense of solidarity, that doesn't mean that's the only way you can get it. People are able to build communities, you know, such as this one.
Yeah, you spoke about that. Right. And the joy of giving or volunteering and helping. And often that was stifled through a religious environment where that might have been just channeled particularly for the religious entity's aims or just toward people of the same faith. We might have held back from helping people in our greater community who are not part of our belief structure because they were considered unworthy or to be feared or to be treated with caution. Whereas those who maybe break away from that religious bubble are able to volunteer and actually help lots of people in the community. And I think your point there about volunteering is brilliant, Cara.
Oh, thank you.
And like, just to piggyback that off of that, Sasha, also using the volunteering as a recruitment tool to get people mm-hmm. into the religion. So there's this, you know, hey, we're going to give you food, or, you know, we'll help you, you know, with a project, whatever, or we'll do a donation drive, but you have to, you know, mm-hmm. to start coming to Sunday service and Bible study and stuff like that to recruit people in, you know, instead of just genuinely giving to be kind.
Right. Yeah, awesome. Absolutely. So, you know, kind of with that in mind, I'm going to kind of start wrapping up here and tell y'all about, you know, how I think about, what religion is good for. I subscribe to what I call the holy guacamole model of religious belief. And what I mean by that is, it seems to me that religion is kind of like one of several delivery vehicles for some things that help us in society, whether it's a sense of community or, you know, comfort or meaning in life. It's kind of like the chips to the guacamole. You're just eating the chips to get the guacamole. The chips are the delivery vehicle. But you know what? In my house, I like to eat guac with a spoon or put it on some delicious fajitas or tacos. I don't need the extra calories from the chips. Leave them off. Hold the chips for me. And there are people out there that really enjoy their chips. You know, maybe they get the, you know, hint of lime flavored chips and they just really enjoy that part of the experience. Well, that's fine. They can eat their chips to get the guac, but don't push them onto me. Maybe I'm gluten intolerant or bullshit intolerant, as the case may be. And I just want the guac, and we don't have to have that particular delivery vehicle to get it. And the guac in this case is, you know, the good stuff, the community, the solidarity, the meaning, and all that. So that's kind of how I think about religion in society. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that, but that's where I land when I think about, you know, the pros and cons. So that's, oh, go ahead.
Well summed up.
No, yeah, that's well said. I agree with you. I'm pretty much there with you as well.
Fair enough. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think then it's time to go into the question phase, and bonus points for anybody that can identify the movie that this graphic is from, with Captain Kirk saying, "Excuse me, I just have a question."
Come on, chat, bring it in. Okay. Anybody in the chat that can identify, we'll give this a few moments.
It's a tragically underrated movie, in my opinion.
See if you can drop it into the chat if you've got any ideas.
All right. Yes, it is. It's Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, the one where they meet the quote-unquote God character, and Kirk says, you know, well, what does God need with a starship? It's a fun movie about, you know, questioning what benefits religion brings us. So go back and rewatch it. I know everyone says it's the worst one ever, but I disagree. That's my hot take for today. And
wonderful.
So don't come after me in the chat. Well, you can, but yeah, what does God need with my money? Yeah, basically that's the question.
Brilliant presentation, Kara. Thank you so much. And we do have lots of questions that came in from the chat throughout your presentation too. So maybe Helen and I can put some of those. First off, I just want to apologize to anyone if we have missed your question in the chat. It was not deliberate. It was just maybe an oversight from us, because there were a lot of comments and chats coming through. But can we put some of those to you, Kara, that came through?
Absolutely. Lay them on me.
All right. Well, one of the first ones was, are humans predisposed to religion? You kind of covered this already, but...
Yeah. It's an interesting question. There have been some cognitive anthropologists. I'm thinking of Scott Atran in particular. I think he covers that in a book called, what is it called? In Gods We Trust. And I believe he goes over this kind of idea that, well, it may be that superstitious or supernatural belief is something that is kind of a normal or natural outgrowth of, you know, some of the cognitive processes and biases that we as humans use to make decisions in the world. Kind of the way we develop, you know, heuristic models of the world might lead us to certain superstitions, you know, kind of this, I think Rob actually has talked about it in some of his talks about cognitive bias, where, you know, kind of, well, it may be advantageous in a sense of survival if, you know, we are a little bit superstitious about things. If we notice, well, when I did X, Y happened. So, ooh, maybe I should keep doing X, and maybe I'm going to attribute sort of a supernatural reason for that, or kind of our tendency to imagine patterns and meanings behind things that may in fact just be random. So yes, there may be some cognitive sort of leaning in that direction, but I don't know that it's necessarily inevitable, but I'm not an expert on that. So that's all I got on that. It's a maybe, cognitively speaking, probably. We are certainly prone to superstitious beliefs, and we're very easy to trick. And it's even easier to trick ourselves when we think we're seeing patterns in things and making meanings out of things that may not be there.
We are not objectionable creatures. We're not very good at that.
No. And also, I do want to go back to, again, you know, we kind of touched around this, but, you know, there is a strong desire to be in the in-group for people in general. That's a survival tactic, right? Like, I don't want to be left behind by my parents or my family or my group to fend for myself. I want to be a part of the group that's going to help me, you know, not get killed and not starve to death and not die of exposure. And that usually means trying to get along with people. And so if there is a strong pressure to conform to a certain belief system, it's in my best interest to get along and go along sometimes. And so, you know, we do have that pressure on us. So, yeah.
All right, I'm gonna move on to the next one. Thank you for answering that one, Kara. Sure. How do you differentiate a cult from a religion or a tribal belief? Does the number of adherents have a bearing?
Great question. I think that there's a couple of different angles that you could answer that from. I like that you asked, you know, does the number of adherents matter? And I think that gets at the fact that a lot of times we use the term cult in kind of a pejorative way, where religion is, you know, something that's established and accepted, and a cult is like, you know, the offshoot. It's the wrong version, in heavy air quotes, of the religion. So I think in some ways, calling something a cult is just a way of putting a value label on it. So yeah, if fewer people belong to it, then the people who are in the larger group are probably going to call that a cult. You know, I've heard people say that, you know, Christianity, when it first started, would have been considered a cult, but now that it's one of the major world religions, you're not going to get away with calling it that. Now they're the ones that can say, oh, well, this offshoot, Mormonism is the cult now. So yes, I think it does have to do with how many adherents, but people who study cults tend to have a different model for that. Like, I know we've talked on here before about the bite model, where it's to what extent does the belief system exert a level of control over your life? And I think the bite stands for, is it behavioral?
Information, thought, and emotion.
Yeah. So to what extent is the belief system kind of absorbing you and taking over your whole life in those four areas is how we would kind of try to take an objective stab at answering that. But I think you also do have a point, you know, suggesting that, well, if something is smaller and less popular, it's probably more susceptible to getting labeled that way by the dominant group too.
And I think it depends on, like, you know, how it's seen in the culture at large, you know, even to people that aren't religious or from a religious group, because I'm sure Sasha can attest to this, you know, to people that don't know the inner workings of Jehovah's Witnesses, just see it as just another religion, you know. Mm-hmm. But then when you actually get into the insidiousness that happens to the members inside the group, you know, then you find out all the culty behavior that, you know, and the things that have happened within that religion, you know. Mm-hmm. Compared to like myself, who grew up Catholic, but also had a really good science education. I didn't have to cut out people from my life if I left the religion, you know, and that sort of thing, you know. Like, I'm not saying that the Catholic Church doesn't have problems, because it got problems, but as far as the control and things like that, it's a different line compared to, I'm sure, what Sasha and Sherry experienced.
Yeah, interesting thoughts, Helen. Yeah, very much so. And yet it's also being well said that some of the largest religions have cult-like activities and behaviors. Mm-hmm. For example, religions that talk about blood sacrifice and bodies turning, bits of bread turning into flesh of Christ. And, you know, so the size of religions, but accurately, as you say, to the consequences of not adhering to those religions, would that tip them more toward the definition of a cult? Perhaps. But really, any group that exercises control over people.
Yeah, I mean, like, well, I mean, we had to confess, you know, our sins to a priest every Sunday, you know. Mm. So we, you know, if you did something wrong, or like you swore at your mom or whatever. Yeah. So, you know, there's a level of control there too, you know, and like there's a lot of gray area, you know, definitely in this topic.
Yeah. I want to go back to what you said, Sasha, that I love that. I had an anthropology professor one time who asked everybody in the class when we got to the segment about religion and said, okay, how many of you here practice cannibalism? And, you know, of course, nobody raised their hand. And then she says, oh, really? How many of you have ever taken communion as part of a religious ritual? And, you know, like something like 80% of people in the class raised their hand. And she's like, you're eating the body and blood of your deity? That's cannibalism.
Yeah.
Funny you don't call it that.
Well, when you put it that way, now you're making it sound gross.
I think several people may have deconverted from their faith as a result of that class before it was over.
Yeah. No. Great life lesson.
Yeah. They're like, oh.
We've got another couple of questions here. Are we still going okay for time? You're all right to stay for a longer? Yeah.
Yeah.
You did cover this to a certain extent. Is a belief in a supernatural being required for a religion?
Yeah. I would say technically, no. Typically, that is part of a religion. And a lot of times we kind of think of that as one of the defining elements of a religion. But, you know, like I mentioned, there are non-theistic religions out there. For example, the Satanic Temple, if you want to count that one. And then we have, you know, some of the other belief systems that we described that may have some elements of spiritualism or kind of a reverence for elements of the natural world that may be worshipped or celebrated in various ways that are not technically supernatural. So yes, it is possible. It's not common, but yes, it is possible.
Okay. All right. So somebody was asking when you brought up the gender diversity before, what is the evidence for that in different religions? Because obviously those of us living in the West, we haven't seen a whole lot of that. So, you know, I think there was some curiosity of, you know, where that was seen in other religions throughout the world.
So there are actually a lot. And I do want to refer people back to, let me put that link actually in the chat. Hold on one second. Let me get that one from PBS. Has a great sort of world map. Let me pull that up real quick. That goes over different areas of the world. Here it is. That have a tradition of gender expansive people or non-binary gender diversity. And a couple that I can talk about off the top of my head would be in India, for example, has a long history of having what is sometimes called a third gender of people, the Hijra, who actually fulfill very important ceremonial roles within religious practices there that goes back centuries. Somebody can probably Google real quick how far back that goes. I can't say off the top of my head, but it is quite a long tradition in history in which people are kind of regarded as important for sacred events and things like that. It's usually people who were assigned male at birth, but then identify with more feminine traits and qualities and are sort of representative of sort of important, meaningful practices. And it's similar in a lot of places around the world. There are a lot of Native American cultures, indigenous cultures that have a history. I think the most common one that we hear, a term that we hear all the time, is two-spirit. That is native to certain indigenous groups in the United States, where once again, it's regarded as sort of a special quality that someone would have if they were born, you know, and identified or assigned, you know, male or female at birth, but as they grew up, you know, sort of came to embody a different, more expansive gender expression and identity, that was actually regarded as, you know, well, you're actually very special because you can embody sort of both halves of the deities, as it were, you know, right? You have both the male and the female, you know, in one, and therefore you're a really special and rare commodity. And that kind of thinking is prevalent in a lot of areas of the world. I don't have an exact date for you on that. Oh yeah, somebody's putting Joan of Arc in the chat. I've seen discussion and hypotheses being thrown out about a lot of figures such as Joan of Arc historically, who probably by today's standards, you know, may have been regarded as gender nonconforming or an example of a non-binary gender expression. You know, in some cases, it's hard to say because we don't have the historical records that are using the same terms that we're using and things like that. But in most parts of the world, there is a long tradition of these people existing, because, you know, non-binary people exist. That's a thing that's been consistent, you know, across the world and through time, about as far back as we have historical records. And I apologize that I don't have an exact date for you. I'm going to look for that and get back to you, though, shortly.
That's excellent. We had another very good question, just to go on a different tangent. Humans, of course, music plays a very big role for humans around the world. What's your thoughts with music in religious services? Mm-hmm. Is there a way or a role that music can play for humanist gatherings or non-religious people? Is music used to bond people? How does religion and music interact?
That's an interesting question. It reminds me of the talk that we had from Dr. Ray recently, I think, where, when was that one? That was talking about sort of the role of emotion in religion. And yes, I think we talked in that one about the ways that, you know, you can strategically play the moving music at the right moment when you're going to pass around the collection plate or give people a call to action. So yes, I think as something that is connected for a lot of people with, you know, a deeply emotional experience that is very tied into what people get out of religious ceremonies where people are coming together to celebrate or worship or meditate or whatever they're doing. Yes, I think music is very often used to facilitate that. And yeah, I think that's a great point. Could we use more music? Yes. I think what I'm hearing is we need more theme music, which we do have some theme music in the secular community. We have some really cool stuff. I know the ACA also has some cool stuff from the same artist. So yes, I agree. And we need more. And, you know, the title of this talk should, you know, sort of recall a song that we all may be familiar with. But I didn't play it.
So getting back to when we were talking about animism and like the spirit, like spiritualism rather through nature rather than like through a deity. So are there many religions that link natural world to divinity? And do you think the environment has the effect?
Oh, like because of the environment that they live in, the belief system was more sort of reverent of it?
That's what I'm getting from this question. If the person that posted it wanted to clarify in chat while we're talking, I will sure to add your little notes in if I'm getting you wrong.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Given the kind of crisis that we're having currently with the climate and how we've been treating the natural world. A lot has been written on the connection between this kind of dualistic Western thinking that, you know, grew out of the Enlightenment period that not only spread, you know, certain religions around the world, but that also sort of propagated this idea that, you know, man has domination over nature. This idea that, you know, God gave the planet and the animals to Adam and Eve, mainly Adam, to steward and use as they see fit. And we see this kind of push to use the environment. And that does contrast greatly with a lot of more traditional beliefs about the environment. We see even today this conflict all the time between, for example, when it's time to build a natural gas pipeline that's going through indigenous lands, we see this push between the governments of the heavy air quotes developed and modern society, running up against this concern and respect for nature and the environment and the natural world of the indigenous people. And we see, you know, this kind of running over of sacred places and using the environment for some sort of material gain rather than living in a more harmonious way with it. And yeah, I consider that very problematic. And we do see that a lot in a lot of the more older religious beliefs in a lot of indigenous communities that, you know, got railroaded by Western people. There, I said it. It caused a lot of problems.
Thank you. No, well said. Yeah. Could religion, here's another one that came in the chat, could religion be considered mankind's first attempts at explaining the world around us? Is it perhaps, you know, a first attempt at science, or what we might now call science, understanding how we relate to the world?
I think so. I think that's one way to think about it. It's interesting, you know, to see like the hypotheses that have been put forth about like, okay, how did religion start? What was it for at first? And And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If we look at, you know, oral traditions and, you know, the ways that people might, you know, come up with origin stories, yes, it's imparting knowledge and tradition. But yeah, it's explanatory a lot of times, even if it may not be meant to be taken literally. I think a lot of, you know, traditions that we have, you know, grow out of an attempt to explain why is the world the way that it is. And sometimes it tries to give specific explanations to things like what causes lightning or, you know, where do diseases come from? And yet we don't necessarily need religion to answer those questions anymore because we do have more sophisticated scientific methods. But I agree that that may have been, you know, an early attempt. There's also, I think it was Tyler, I'm trying to think of the anthropologist who talked about, this kind of hypothesis that it might have also been an attempt to explain sort of what happens to people after they die. What's going on if I have a dream or a vision and I'm seeing something that doesn't appear, you know, to be present in the natural world? Well, you know, maybe religion can kind of explain these otherworldly experiences and kind of make sense of the things that we just don't know the answer to. So yes, I think it very often stands in for, oh, I don't know, so let's fill that in with an explanation, you know?
Right. Well, okay, excellent. And is religiosity affected by age, or does age affect religiosity, might be the best way to say it?
Ooh, excellent question. That probably depends on where you live. I don't want to say across the board, but somebody who has quicker Google skills than me can probably Google this real quick. I think the breakdown that we see, and again, I'm most familiar with statistics in the US, so I apologize that that is not a very global perspective on my part. So people who are coming from different places, please jump into the conversation here. But I think we definitely see that in the US, that more of the nuns, the people who identify with none of the above religious affiliation, tend to come from the under 35 crowd, and even the 35 to 45. As compared to the older generation, the boomer generation, and on, yes, there is that correlation there with age. And I would say that, you know, to my mind, that speaks to, you know, some of the shifts in values that are important to people, that, you know, younger people may not feel like they're being served by what some of the major religions in the community around them are putting out. So they're going away
makes
from
sense.
It. Yeah, that's my hypothesis anyway. Somebody else could have a totally different take on that. But yes, I believe the numbers do bear that out though. Yeah, here wow. Anyway.
Thank you. That's pretty well most of the questions that were put through the chat. But were there any others, Helen? Or?
Oh, I see Dr. Ray has pointed out a counterexample. In places like Sweden, where more people are secular, you don't see that difference in religious belief over time. So right. That's interesting.
Very interesting. Wow. Thank you, Kara. And I'm sure everybody shares in thanking you very much for this presentation today. We really appreciated everything that you gave us and gave us a lot to think about, too. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. I love learning new stuff. I love new things in my noodle. Thank you, Kara.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for letting me come talk to you.
We really appreciate it.
You got to be in the hot seat this week.
Yeah, I figured, you know, I might as well do it. I ask people to come every week and get interviewed and grilled with questions. And, you know, I have never subjected myself to that. So, you know, it's only fair.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.